the odds to keep some of the big content providers, the big names. Those are going to go to Rumble, and Rumble's just going to continue to grow. So here's this IPO. They're trading at about $12.
Eric, your web page is www.planetwaves.net.fm.
You're in with Dolores Cahill on today's PlanetWave.fm
is better.
TNT.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Dolores Cahill Show. And my guest today, all the way from the United States, is Eric Coppolino. And just to give you a little background on Eric, that he's a lifelong student of the media. And he's basically been looking at aspects of how it transforms both individual people and society. And he's going to, I'm sure, give us a short intro. But his father was Professor Dr. Joseph Coppolino. And he and his father were both involved in media from his earliest childhood. And he's gone on to study the effects of the mass media, and also personally with the family of Marshall McLuhan, which is on "The Media is the Message," was his famous catchphrase. So he's also written for a wide diversity of publications, including the Daily Mail and the Ecologist, from the Woodstock Times to the New York Times. And he's internationally acclaimed and also has his own radio show every Friday. And his website is www.planetwaves.net. So, Eric, it's a warm welcome to the Dolores Cahill Show. How are you?
Thank you, Dolores. Good morning. And doing wonderful here in New York.
Eric,
yes.
Yeah, it's very early in the morning, Eric. And if you wanted to just add anything, or even just to maybe mention as well what you've been doing in the last 2.5 years, just as an initial warm-up in relation to this COVID-19 issue.
Well, the last 2.5 years were an extension of what I've done basically ever since I could, you know, bang into a typewriter. And quite early in my journalistic work, I stumbled into the issue of mass contamination incidents. So I started writing about those at age 19 and have covered many facets of government and of corporate life all through the years, and then became an astrologer as a kind of a spiritual vacation in the mid-1990s. You know, I had gone for nearly a decade, actually 12 years, covering really intense journalistic subjects and government people and corporate malfeasance and all that stuff, and I needed a new way to relate to the world, that other way of looking at things that the Course in Miracles talks about. So for me, that became going deep into my esoteric studies, and I emerged a year later writing a horoscope column that I still write, and amazingly ended up in British publications, which is the highest compliment that you can possibly get as a horoscope writer, to be accepted as one anywhere in Great Britain, and was soon writing for the publications of the writers I admired the very most. So that included the Mirror and the Mail and some papers down in Australia and a syndicate run by Jonathan Kaner. You probably heard of Jonathan Kaner, who passed away.
I have.
So I was his vacation stand-in, and that got me a lot of got a lot of opportunities from that.
Excellent. And I suppose, you know, you're the first astrologer really I have met, and I know that, like, having looked at, let's say, Max Planck and a lot of the physicists and people who've actually spent their lives studying, we'll say, matter and science and the quantum theory and quantum entanglement. And even I actually interviewed and met a dear friend, Professor Matthias Desmet, who has studied, we'll say, the psychology and, you know, has been highlighting this thing called mass formation. But even they were all touching on that the more you study, we'll say, matter and this rational science, it does open up into that there is a divine component, a mathematical component, and that in a way has been hidden from us. And that is part, isn't it, of the spectrum of astrology. But for people who don't know what astrology is, if you wanted to maybe introduce us for a few minutes, Eric?
Sure. Astrology is, in a sense, the study of synchronicities. I don't advertise ever, if I slip in my language, okay, maybe, but astrology is the study of many different cycles, sun, moon, planets, and how they interrelate to one another. But then when you have a question or a person, you're looking at a place where all those cycles are in a kind of a freeze frame. They stop. They don't really stop, but you take a picture at the moment of birth, and you study that picture, and the things that you see are meaningful because they are kind of a synchronicity. So the patterns and the cycles overlap, and astrology requires an open mind and not being conclusive, but more being observational and letting the conclusions come very gently and naturally. Because I find I never want to guide anything into a corner, but rather leave an open-ended study. So if we look at astrology from a media studies perspective, and I've got a wonderful video with Andrew McLuhan, the grandson of Marshall McLuhan, if we look at astrology from a media perspective, media studies, the language is round. And so this is the thing about it. There are as many glyphs on the chart, if you add up all the numbers and all the planets, the sun and the moon and all that stuff, as a couple of paragraphs in a newspaper. But with that limited number of options, you can go on for days talking about the chart because everything in the chart relates to every other thing in the chart. So there's no wasted relationships. In reading a sentence in the Soroway Sun, the letter at the beginning of the paragraph has nothing to do with the letter that ends the paragraph. But in an astrology chart, every symbol in the chart relates to every other symbol. So it's an extremely efficient use of a tiny amount of data that then expands into this thing. And there's many ways to mathematically derive additional charts. The thing is that one needs experience to do this and a very open mind and also a level of sensitivity to the human dimension. So there's a therapy skill involved in working with people and that you really have to listen to what people are saying. I think rather than do the hocus pocus, spooky, predictive kind of a thing, I prefer to not do that. I take a little bit more of a modern approach. One other thing, which is that I study the astrology of events. So this dovetailed perfectly with my life as a news journalist because I got out of the news journalism for a while to just go into my spiritual side for a while. Doing the journalism work is a form of combat. I mean, it's really Marshall McLuhan called it, World War III is the world information war, where there's no distinction between civilian and military combatants. So here I am, a Quaker, in the middle of the world information war. I'm like, I've got to stop for a while. So I start relating to the world as a horoscope writer in the mid-90s, but very, very quickly discover that news events have charts that can be very interesting to write about and talk about. So I started doing the astrology of events.
That is wonderful. And maybe if you just want to give some background about how you were in touch with the McLuhan and Marshall McLuhan family and his impact, we'll say, on you and his phrase about the media is the message. What does that mean and the connection there?
Well, that's the thing like printed on the bookmark, right? But it is something that could easily be discussed for an entire, 1 week long seminar. So I first heard Marshall McLuhan at the dinner table from my dad driving around on divorce weekend because he was doing his PhD in a form of media studies at New York University, which was kind of a hub of like early beachhead of media studies at NYU in New York City, posh university. And, it's quite a lovely PhD to have. And but when you're somebody's kid, you're finding out about, especially if they're a teacher, you're going to hear about it. So he talked about what he was doing, and it was a real thing. And in the spirit of the medium is the message. It actually didn't matter which facet of media studies my father was looking at. What mattered was that he was looking at the media critically. He was looking at it. This is in the 1960s. He would watch the TV news with a microphone taped to the television set. This is before VCRs and Betamaxes and all this stuff. So I understood that the news wasn't something you just take in as a going out for a hot cocoa, you just slurp it down, but rather you look at it critically, you record it, you document it, you preserve it, you analyze it. That was the message that I got from this. So I proceed into a journalism career at that point, and I wound up in a high school that gave me a lot of freedom to do publishing activities called John Dewey High School in Brooklyn. I had 11 publications at the time that I was there, a high school in New York City with 11 printed publications. One was weekly. Some of them were three or four times a year. Some came out periodically. There was a law school journal called Opita Dictum. There was a feminist journal called Fireworks. And I was the editor of the Social Science Journal, one of the oldest ones in the school, called The Gadfly. Perfect for me. And I learned through Gadfly editing and how to recruit staff. I learned from Ira Zornberg, who was also the Holocaust studies teacher. He ran the Social Science Journal. And I learned from the way he recruited me how to recruit people. I would bring my lunch up to the publication office. And one day he kind of grabbed me and said, "You're going to do this. Let's go." So I became a 24/7 recruiter from that moment forward, always looking for talent, and became the editor-in-chief and learned editing, writing, newspaper production. I went to the printing plant. I didn't have to, but I went. Then I got a job working at the design studio where the place was done. I worked there for 2 summers and learned a lot. By the time I was out of high school, I basically had everything I needed to do to work in the trade. So that set me up for a really interesting independent journalism career. And it was something I read in one of McLuhan's old books that made me realize, really, what I need is a typewriter and a Xerox machine to be a publisher. That's what he says in a book called The Medium is the Massage, not Message, the Massage. The medium is the rub. The medium, it was a typo, and he kept it. The book came back with the wrong, somebody misspelled the title of the book on the cover, and he liked it and kept it. That's McLuhan.
Very good. Very
so
good.
I learned that. So right away, I start publishing little things and satires and newsletters using a typewriter and a copy machine, because people could go to work and get copies made. Unlike now, where you can just print them out at home, you had to go to work. They didn't even have copy centers. Somebody at work had to have the machine. So people encouraged my activities and would, you know, bring me back a stack of copies of the thing I had done. So that's the childhood part.
No, that's very interesting. And I suppose then you moved on to work with the internet and the media. And what are your thoughts really on how the internet, or this change from the traditional media to the internet, and its impact on society?
That brings me into my relationship with the McLuhan family. So one day I posted something to Facebook, and I talked about an idea of McLuhan's, which is that the environment we're in is invisible. And this is the essence of McLuhan's work, that it's a study of the environment, which is why they were chuffed that an astrologer came along and explained how astrology relates exactly to what they were doing, because it's a form of environmental study. It's taking an invisible environment, using special tools and perceptions, and making it visible and comprehensible. So anyway, I make this comment about the environment being invisible, and this guy, Andrew McLuhan, replies to my comment. And I thought, this has got to be a coincidence. But no, it was the grandson of Marshall and was the son of Eric, Marshall's oldest son, who is his assistant and co-writer for many years. And that began a relationship where Andrew and I basically worked together with guidance from his dad to figure out what the internet was doing to people and to society. And so to learn this, I had to essentially learn the whole theory. And the whole theory is that every time a new medium is introduced, a medium meaning a technological change that shifts the entire environment. So, for example, going from not having telegraph to having telegraph is a tectonic change, because suddenly humans who normally would, you know, stand in a park and have a conversation or on a street corner could suddenly communicate at the speed of light. And so the first telegraph conversation was a chess game, but it didn't matter what the content was, because they could conduct this chess game between, I think, Baltimore and New York City at the speed of light. But nobody could see this. But this chess game is going on behind the scenes at the speed of light, transforming the human condition basically right under everyone's nose. Then comes telephone, then comes electricity, then comes radio and the movies, and then comes, well, back in there are wire services transmitting photos across the ocean and news stories being transmitted by telegraph. This is sort of, Reuters begins as a carrier pigeon, a carrier pigeon service. It's why I love Reuters, of all the players in the media environment. Whenever I'm talking to a Reuters person, I remind them that they started with carrier pigeons, but quickly went to being a wire service with sending photos and copy across the ocean using, you know, various more advanced forms of telegraph. Every time that happens, the human race rearranges its consciousness and rearranges all of its, the use of its senses, and rearranges its social patterns. So these are completely transformative events happening one after the next, but nobody but freakazoids like McLuhan are noticing this because he just thought it was interesting, and he studied originally the impact of text. So he was trying to figure out what the printing press did to people and found out that it what was the single most profound rearrangement of consciousness, creating things like the subject-object divide and getting people to hear little sounds in their mind which had nothing to do with the thing printed on the paper. But, you know, talking leaves, as the Indians call them, books could suddenly talk, but to look at the page makes no sense unless you're trained in the use of a phonetic alphabet. The phonetic alphabet completely rearranged our minds and our sense of identity and our idea that we have an inner being and that there is a thing called the public. And so it changed everything.
And yes. Eric, would you say that it is changing for good or changing for bad? Or obviously there's both good and bad. What do you think is it? Has that change in the people's mind or consciousness? What's the main, we'll say, positive and negative aspects of that?
Well, following the example of Marshall, it is perhaps better to set judgment aside and to observe the effects. So if we stick to the internet, when we observe the effects of the internet, we find out that it has a very highly disorienting effect on people. This is the kind of stuff that was going on Get Smart 50 years ago that we're having this conversation. It was the stuff going on major television networks only 20 years ago that we're having an international broadcast. I'm in my pajamas. So that's to put this power in the hands of individual people is an enormous shift in their self-concept, and it can be very, very confusing. The problem is people do not notice their confusion, and when we end up in this cyber environment, this alternate reality, this astral plane that we're communicating on now, we come here without our bodies, we come here without things like pheromones and hormones and gender. You sound like a woman to most people. I sound like a man to most people. But we're still meeting in this environment shorn of gender. We can transform our genders. We can just pretend that we're someone else. It's a very strange thing. This has a knock-on effect. I guess it's probably a bad word for it, but a knock-on effect of destabilizing everything. So if we're wondering what this destabilization of culture and society is and of intellect, where what is rationally provable suddenly no longer matters to a lot of people, we can thank digital consciousness for this. Many of the really weird things you look at and just say, that's freaking weird. Why is that going on? Why do these people believe that? Why, how, what is possible? Well, the effect is a digital effect. And what we experienced with COVID was a digital effect that actually happened long before COVID. COVID was just new content that came along. It wasn't the thing itself. It was just the next stage of the content being shoved into the platform. And it turned out that the content was a bunch of computer code that was called, you know, MN908947.3. That's this terrible virus going around. Or 402123, this other terrible virus going around, of which there are now 13 million. And that became the content of a pre-existing transformed human race and a network of communication fiber optics and satellite networks and Bluetooth and Wi-Fi and all this already plastered around the entire globe, turning the entire globe into an extended nervous system. Is it good or bad? Well,
so one of the things, just so that I'm clear, is so we have all these ways of communicating, and then we have, we'll say, the radiation or Wi-Fi or whatever, the method of communication. But just how does that affect the rationality or the consciousness in the way that you're saying? How does it actually work?
Well, how it works is that, hopefully I'm answering your question, every time a new technology emerges, the nervous system is extended in a new way. The nervous system is transformed so that your ear now comes all the way out to this microphone. So you don't think you're sitting in my office, but you've got this gadget that I put here a while ago, but now you're incarnating in my microphone, and I'm whispering in your ear, oh, but also consequently the ear of thousands of people remotely around the world. This is highly destabilizing, but it's destabilizing because it is an extension of the central nervous system out to the far reaches of the planet. Every time there's a new media transformation in society, that changes. And now it is into everyone's home. Suddenly everyone's a vlogger, blogger, podcaster, broadcaster, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is freaky. This is very intense. And so what often happens is that it's so intense, people shut down. They can't stand the sensitivity of it. It is destabilizing to be leaping across the ocean like this. You're in England, I guess, now, right? So you're like 3,000 miles away from me. We are leaping across the ocean. You say, no, we're not. I'm just talking on an old iMac. Well, no, we're leaping across the ocean, actually, and it's very destabilizing. And so what happens is people want to cut off from that. And so the digital haze, in my view, is the extend, cut off phenomenon. You extend. It's very exhilarating. Oh, my God, I'm texting with somebody in China. Isn't that incredible? I'm on AOL with somebody. I have no idea who or where they are. But it's so intense, we tend to, most people, cut off because they can't stand it. It's too much. And it's a lot of change all at once. So they cut off. That's the haze.
So you know the way that we'll say when you come from, you know, the natural law, universal law, the divine realm or wherever, there's this thing about morality and ethics, and that part of the consciousness and what we were talking in the first hour is that the juries actually tap into their conscience and their, you know, innate understanding of the realm that they're in and the moral, you know, remit or consequences of actually doing something that goes against, so that you wouldn't do something that is lying, we'll say, that you should speak in honor and in truth. Mm-hmm, but part of that is the karma, or that we're all connected, right? That is part of the thing about karma, and that there are consequences of wronging someone that will kind of echo through the connectedness. Do you think that when people come with new technologies, and why you're saying that people actually get frozen and don't like the technology, is it that in some way the technology is interfering with the natural kind of connectedness, and then that causes a disconnect in people?
Yeah, good one. They like it, but it numbs them out. I think that every time there's a shift in technology, there's also a corresponding new morality or ethics that exists within that realm. And on the internet, it is very easy to lie. The internet has a self-documenting quality to it. We could be being recorded 1,000 times now. But it is also the place where anything can be accepted as true. And people can invent themselves into things like virologist, immunologist, people with degrees from London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And not only isn't it true, but very few people bother to care or check. So it creates a big, wide opening for ethical violations on the internet. And this is destabilization of culture and the disorientation of intellect. And so when you bring book morality to it, which itself has some problems, but it's better than digital morality. When you bring book morality to it, it can seem really strange and conspiratorial to people because it's so rigid and structured and depends upon accepting something as true. And I think I use the example of juries many times. It's very useful instruction because it means that people need to tap in to their conscience in the context of being given a lot of information. And so this is why I never really want to underestimate the intelligence of people. Certainly any American can end up on a jury with the most complicated case in the world and have to sit there for 6 months sorting through the technicalities. And your qualification is that you're not an expert. You are not an expert. You're an ordinary person who's going to listen and do your best to make the right choice.
No, and I think that actually is very, it's very meaningful in a way, and it is part of, I suppose, the awareness that we all need to really go back to, is that the power of all of us of discernment and to try and resonate when someone is actually speaking the truth and then the whole complexity of a particular case. But if it's okay, Eric, my guest today is Eric Francis Coppolino, and we'll take a short break on the Dolores Cahill Show, and we'll be right back.
You should hear what Mark Morano is talking about.
Very good.
Journalism. All
right. Wonderful.
Bought and paid for.
Fun subject.
Well done, Eric. It is an amazing subject. It's beautiful. And I think I've never touched it on the show before. The show's been going on now for about 8 or 9 months. So I think people will really appreciate it, Eric. So will we stick with the questions that you sent, or do you want to bring up any issue?
No, let's keep with it. And I can talk more about how this COVID thing went from being non-existent to existent, if that's okay.
Yes, of course. You just say to me now how you'd like me to introduce it, and basically you have 30 minutes, so I won't interrupt you. So
definitely. Questions help. Your questions really help. They move the conversation along and help me refocus. So I'm definitely interested in what you're asking. You represent your listeners, so think for them.
Exactly, and I think of someone who knows, has no understanding at all of the subject, you know.
So why don't we recap?
And I am. Yeah, could. Okay, perfect. Yep. Yeah. And then we'll touch into the COVID-19.
Yes.
You know, as well as the issue of the digital and the spiritual. But if you want to, I'll say we'll just recap, and then I can then just ask you if what are your thoughts of this in relation to COVID-19.
Yeah, I think it's the most important spiritual issue that we're facing right now is the digital
Visit
impact.
AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
This is where you get your daily ration of high-velocity conversation. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Dolores Cahill Show on TNTRadio.live. And my guest today is Eric Francis Coppolino. And Eric, if you just want to maybe recap what we were discussing around the importance of digital and new technologies and media and how that can affect people. And maybe we'll then go into what's been happening since this era of COVID-19.
Wonderful. Thank you. So just to sum up, the concept of media studies is studying the impact of technological transformation on the human experience. This is a study of the invisible for the most part, because the various technologies we use become ubiquitous and invisible, and the environment that they create is invisible. So it's really a kind of a Zen study in awareness. It immediately becomes a spiritual practice. Marshall McLuhan, by the way, read the Bible in five languages every morning. That's how he warmed up. He was a polyglot, and just to get his brain working on all channels, I'm told that is what he did. And he also hung out with a lot of Roman Catholic priests. But anyway, the idea of media studies is the study of the invisible environment and how it changes us. So that can lend itself to some controversy, but you have to be sensitive and pay attention and notice the effects. This is what McLuhan said over and over. Notice the effects of things. And that's a bit special. Now, people think of media studies often as studying the content. And the content can be interesting, and the content can follow from the transformational results of what this did to us. What did the telephone do to people? Well, then secondarily, what do we talk about on the phone? What did the internet do to people? Well, what's the content? On the internet, the content is pure psychedelia. There's no... If you were to have a room with 1,000 of these screens on it, there would be no continuity whatsoever to the content of the internet. So it is the thing that is transforming us. And this is very challenging for people. This is the meaning of the phrase, the medium is the message. What he meant by that was that the environment is the thing that is actually conveying the transformative, let's say, information, rather than the content riding along the train. It is the train itself that is transforming us, not whether it's first class or coach.
And is that just the technology, we'll say, the interference of the technology or the radio waves or the radiation to our kind of connectedness and spiritual realm? You know, is it the very presence of it, or what is it, if it is the technology itself?
Well, it's how we utilize our senses and how we utilize our mind. Now, I think that we should rightly study anything that is invisible that we know is there, which would include the impact of Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and that vibration. Here we get into a thing requiring more scientific study and less philosophical study, but the metaphor of all these disconnected devices actually being connected is a kind of a symbol of interconnectedness that is all throughout the spiritual texts. It's on every page of A Course in Miracles. And so we are working in this metaphor of disconnected things being connected. I think it would be very helpful if we realized we as humans have far superior powers of communication without these devices than we do with them. But we are in this environment now, and we can certainly be utilizing those non-physical senses in this environment now. That is perfectly sensible and an expansion of the idea. But while we're in this environment, the key thing is to stay awake and not numb out. That's the spiritual path. Right, the whole spiritual path is stay awake and don't numb out. If somebody collapses in a train station, you don't step over them. You stop and you get help. The first thing you do is you stop. You prevent everyone else from stepping over them. And you say, yo, go get a cop. Okay, that's being awake. That's how we have to be in this environment in all of its many, many forms. Responding to people calling out for help, for example, whether it's on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. Respond directly to the person. Bring the ethics of the physical, spiritual world, the same thing you're supposed to do every place else. Love your neighbor everywhere you go, including here. It's challenging because people can become real dicks on the internet that they wouldn't be in physical life. They can say things and they can think it's okay to steal and they think it's okay to
lie
and bash people around and exaggerate and insult people and flame and disrupt things that they would never ever be caught doing in a civilized public situation. They'd be in handcuffs and probably deserve it for some of the behavior that I see on the internet.
So one of the things then, so how do we find our pathway back to a more, healing in general for people? Because they are numb, but it's actually very interesting to find out really for me that a source of the numbness may be this very insight that that I'd never really thought about before. But do you have any thoughts then about how we can go from the digital realm to the spiritual realm and heal people from this?
A couple of things come to mind. One is to do everything we can to stay connected to the physical world. Electricity has always brought us out of the spiritual world, or out of the physical world, and into this world that is not really spiritual, and that it's not necessarily guided by love. So the problem with digital is it's inducing an out-of-body experience, but without the guidance of a kind of a spiritual beacon of some kind. So we need to keep the spiritual beacons in mind at all times, but also keep ourselves tethered to the physical, to nature, to our physical bodies, but also to a reference point for sanity. So people can do all the downward-facing dogs that they want. It still doesn't mean they're going to really be grounded in their physical body. The indication of being grounded in the physical body is honoring physical laws, taking care of one's being, which means eating well and not poisoning oneself. That all would seem to fit a kind of a spiritual plan. And sanity. The real mark of it took me a long time to figure this out. What did I mean when I said out of body? Well, what I really meant was acting like a crazy person, acting like you have no connection to yourself or to others that is meaningful. And we absolutely must continue to honor that and work our way through physical reality as if it was real. The problem with the internet is it's teaching us that physical reality is not real. Now, I understand that there's a dimension of Maya here, and there's a kind of a secondary reality, and that there's a possibility this is all an illusion. But it's the illusion that we're in and that we've chosen, that we've incarnated into. And so to dismiss it all by saying this is a bunch of BS is a little bit dangerous unless it is guided by a sane philosophy. So A Course in Miracles lesson number one is nothing I see means anything. This is designed to help you dissociate from your previous associations to bring in new ones. But it doesn't mean you should drive your car the wrong way on the freeway. And so the internet's saying, well, why don't you just drive your car the wrong way on the freeway? That is not a good lesson to translate into physical reality. Even if nothing you see means anything, follow the flow of traffic. Then go where you want to go.
Yes. Yes, because a lot of, people in this time are saying, when that say that they are very connected and spiritual, that, everything has already happened, so that we may not have as much influence into what we may do on a day-to-day basis. But if that was the true, that would actually lead people to not standing up for things that were wrong and not actually trying to do good in the world.
Yeah, well, if everything's already happened, then we can just completely relax and not be so competitive. So while we're being so high strung and competitive, that's the thing that we're needing to address. Really, I mean, I learned a long time ago as a journalist that whatever I might have been writing about, the main function I was serving was making all these connections between people. So back in the old days, as a journalist, and I still do it in the new days, is I had a beat I had to work. So I'd have to call this person up at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms once a week and find out first how she was doing, then what was going on. Then I'd call up a Seagram spokesman and talk to him when I was covering beverage alcohol. So I realized early on, and it was early in my Course in Miracles studies, that what I was actually doing was kind of weaving this dharma around the world of people. And this became a guiding light of my journalism, because the reward of my journalism, apart from whatever I may write about and however fun and helpful the articles may be, is in my life personally, is the people that I encounter become my teachers, they become my friends, they become traveling companions. This to me really is the heart of my own journalistic process, building these trusting relationships. My journalism is good because I have trusting relationships with the people that I'm writing about and who are helping me find the things. It's not merely that I just trust them because I feel like it or it's convenient. It's a relationship that builds trust. And there's a lot of work and self-awareness needed to do that, and vulnerability and all that. Please.
Yes, exactly. And maybe, Eric, you have been doing amazing work in the last 2 or 3 years. And, you know, I'm also, say, doing insight into integrity and world integrity projects, just to ask very basic questions, I guess, to learn from what we've done and try and prevent it happening again. But maybe if you just also give some insight into what you've been doing since this COVID-19.
Well, I have a background covering science. So when you do that, you're not afraid to have to learn new technologies as they come along to understand this stuff. So on March 3rd, 2020, I went from largely editing a horoscope website, which covered news events, to saying, I have got to figure out what this COVID test is. So I set out to figure out what the COVID test was. And through another one of these very long, involved, complex series of having relationships with people, I found people who taught me and helped me figure out what this COVID test is. And so, first of all, that's very important to note, is that people helped me. A guy named David Bettini in Italy was the most significant one. I did not get my information about isolation and purification from all the usual sources that we hear from today. I got it from an Italian guy who speaks broken English, but he's an engineer trained in biochemistry and a beautiful writer in English because he really had a work. And he sent me a series of emails that I had to study the daylights out of and put together every line of what he was saying to figure out, for example, what an in silico sequence is. So my discovery was that what we called COVID was on every level a digital phenomenon. Every last thing about it is a digital phenomenon, beginning with a completely transformed population, which has lost its mind and its connection to its body, and which could be convinced that the only purpose of the body is to spread a disease. This is the bottom line message of this whole BS we've been through, that all your body is an attack vector. And you're going to kill grandma and therefore break up with your best friend and don't invite your children to Thanksgiving dinner and don't invite your mother to Thanksgiving and Christmas dinner. Why? Because all the body is an attack vector. That's a consequence of this complete over-immersion in digital technology. So just to give a few examples of how this actually worked, the entire phenomenon that we call a virus is a digital manifestation. It is nothing more than an artificial intelligence construct. Now, I'm happy to prove that. There's a wonderful paper that's essentially done all the work for us by Mark Bailey, 26,000 words. Mike Stone at viralig.com previously was a guest on the program a few weeks ago.
That's right. And Mark was a guest as well.
So yeah, this guy twice. Is good at carrying rocks across the yard. And he... The rocks he carried, it didn't feel like that to him. He was having the time of his life. I asked him to excerpt from Mark Bailey's article, Deconstructing Virology. It's right on planetwaves.fm, called Farewell to Virology. What we find out is that virology is digital. The whole thing is digital. And it only will work in digital people. So therefore, the virus itself is digital. All the metagenomic transcripts are digital and only digital. The computers doing this are all digital. The PCR test is digital. It is being sent around the world on websites and by email. That's digital. When they take a sample out of someone, they put it into a computer. That's digital. When Moderna comes out with a vaccine, quote unquote, unquote, a lot of quotes around that, they admit right on their website, this is like an operating system for a computer. You're just getting a software upgrade. It's a platform. Well, I want the Jimi Hendrix injection. If I'm going to have the Moderna platform, give me the Paul Simon songwriting upgrade. This is what people think. And this is what Moderna proudly said, till they somewhat wisely took it down because people like me got hold of it. But it's the internet, so it still exists. So one of the things I did was something very undigital, which is I started a chronology on March 3rd. And I started putting things in order. This is a radical act in digital when everything is coming at you simultaneously from all directions. You think there's no such thing anymore as a chronology or as in order. And further, all the other chronologies are pushing an agenda. We have this big tent chronology that integrates all the other chronologies and wants to look at all the developments from every viewpoint. This is a radical act. And when you suddenly look at the chronology, you can see what happened because it puts the movie in order. The chronology has got its own website, chironreturn.org. We can say that at the end again, too. It's right on top of this website. It's actually available from pretty much everywhere. And when you read this thing, you realize you can see it is much, much easier to see what happened. That's all I can say.
And I think it in the historical perspective, you know, for those of us who are going to dedicate time to try and hold people accountable for the deception around this whole thing, I think this website is actually very crucial. But the other digital thing that I think that they've done is that they may have put in like digital sequences into the so-called vaccines in order to make them positive for digital PCR tests, but not just for the testing in these years, but they could also put in digital templates that would be positive for testing in the years to come.
All kinds of nucleotides that are enduring that don't break down by natural process. God only knows what's in this thing. God only knows. Literally, like you have to be omniscient to actually know what is in these things, because there's no way to analyze it. You'd have to test for every substance known and unknown. You can't really do that. So you have to look at the effects first. The effects have not been good. The effects have been more than 30,000 people reported dead from the vaccine just in the United States system. But why? This is the real question. Why do people accept this? They would not accept this for the swine flu shot. They would not accept this at other times in history when it was known. Now it's known. They accept it because they're transformed. They accept it because the transhumanism begins with having to deal with mistakes Spellcheck is making. It's subtle. It's subtle at first. And slowly people have been transformed into these kind of mock digital entities who think, well, okay, so they off so many tens of thousands of people. To not care about that is an effect of the digital environment. I'm sorry to say this.
And maybe, Eric... Yeah, no problem. And maybe, Eric, if you would go into detail in that, because I think that's very profound and could also lead to, I guess, we need to understand this. And the other thing that some of the clinical psychologists and sociologists have been saying is because of the education system, just going into rational issues that may not be true, that maybe these combined actually make people in a way lose their mind or somehow not have the ability to think the way they would have before.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm very fortunate to have really excellent educational experiences at every stage of my education. I got to participate. I had intelligent teachers. I've got very, very good karma. Plus, my parents are both teachers. So I learned you argue with these people. You don't just take what they say. Most people do not have that experience. For most people, education is a form of indoctrination where they don't get to participate, express their curiosity or their passion in any way. They're shut down. So I always have to remember that. When I think of other people's educational experiences, for them, it was not an adventure to the High Sierras. It was just a mind-numbing thing they couldn't wait to get over with. And this is carried on. And now the schools are prisons. I would be horrified to be in school now. We had a couple of friendly cops in my high school who you could practically get high with or smoke a cigarette with, at least. who never cared about anything. Now the schools make make airport security look mild. That is not an environment where you can learn. So now we're teaching that. There's no more school to prison pipeline. School is prison. That's it. So we're indoctrinating people into kind of prison planet. At this time. So now we have to stick to our human values and get together. Get together. I would love to have an astrology class that's not on the internet. The problem is people, their interests have become so far flung on the internet that it is hard to get any two people even to agree on one topic. This is a miracle that's happening right now. We're both talking about the same thing at the same time, more or less. Well, astrology groups used to happen in people's living rooms. That was a lot more meaningful and a lot more fun than these endless Zoom meetings that are going on. At least you could have tea.
And yes, yes, I say we're Zoomed out, right?
We are Zoomed out. I'm not really. I fortunately have used it minimally. It's still kind of fresh for me. I've never, well, I've had a couple of Zoom meetings in my company, but not so many. I hate them.
So one of the things, though, if you just want to go back again to how this digital thing makes people numb to the fact that tens of thousands of people have died and that they just accept it. How does that work in their spirit or in their soul?
Okay, let's go slowly here. If people are disconnected from their body, the body's only relevance is a disease vector. You'll expect them to die of a disease. We are insensitive to the numbers. It's irrelevant to think, how do you really think 30,000 people and then multiply by 100? That's what you've got to do with the CDC figures. That's 3 million people. That's unconscionable. You can't even imagine that. And so you have to go back to the one family that lost their child to myocarditis at age 14 from one of these injections and think about them and really connect with that and listen to the stories these people are telling of what's happened to them. The problem is that to regain sensitivity in this environment is to invite yourself to be completely overwhelmed. And so that, too, has to be done very gently. Because it first completely ignites everything, and then it turns it into this kind of zombie show. By the way, zombie shows are very popular in the digital age. Walking Dead and all this. And the first one, Night of the Living Dead, was a product of the TV era by Romero in 1968, where they first had zombies taking over society. Well, TV has similar effects, but at least it provokes action. At least the dead woke up. So there's a metaphor in the dead way. They're still kind of dead. So we need to not be walking dead. We need to not be zombies. And we need to not think we need to shoot the people who we think are zombies. Essentially, we need a lot of practice being sensitive people, hanging out and minding our manners. You might say.
And is there any way to practically, like the way then to do that is to just get people to come together in some kind of just meeting groups or choirs, or is that the solution?
Yeah, especially where there's food and our social activity that's not related to the crisis. The dealing with the crisis should come in my view, as a secondary outcome of that. We need to recognize each other as humans first and practice that kind of contact and that kind of sharing and building trust, learning how to trust each other again. I mean, trust has been taken a terrible beating in the digital age where every other email comes in as a scam. Phishing scams left and right. And your website getting hacked exactly. Once a week. I mean...
And everything that they've done has been to then isolate people, right?
Yeah.
You know, the way where whether it's the masks or people not talking or social distancing or saying if you love someone, don't hug them and don't come and visit them and
come on.
Them die alone.
Yeah. Terrible. 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 Zach Bush has pointed this out brilliantly, that soldiers will walk through live gunfire to rescue their platoon mate And now we're not inviting grandma to dinner. So we're about to run out of time. You can find my show at planetwaves.fm. Brand new show went up last night. Planetwaves, one word, .fm. The astrology site is planetwaves.net, and I have a Substack with a whole blend of things, including old investigative reporting. And it's Planetwaves FM Substack.
Excellent. Very good. And maybe as well, we still have another minute or so, Eric. Have you got any, we'll say, final messages to give people hope or to, you know, from your great insight?
A lot is up to you. It's not up to these big forces in society to rescue us from this, to make a better world, or for that matter, to destroy us. We make many, many decisions every day. And I think that one of my favorite lines in A Course in Miracles is that every decision you make stems from what you think you are. And so...
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah, thank you so much. So my guest today on the Dolores Cahill Show is Eric Francis Coppolino. Thank you very much. All my love. And we'll have you on again, Eric. Lovely
thank you so much.
And thank you, everyone, for listening to the Dolores Cahill Show on TNTRadio.live.